Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump publicly criticizing Vladimir Putin for the first time today in a tweet holding Russia and Iran responsible for backing, quote, the animal Assad, for his use of chemical weapons against women and children, in which Trump threatened that they would pay, quote, a big price. Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind and the forthcoming book In Putin's Footsteps, joins us to discuss why Putin appears to be testing the boundaries of the democratic world's tolerance for human rights atrocities and the flouting of civilized norms. We'll assess whether the latest round of sanctions against Russian oligarchs and government officials, which Trump delayed implementing to the point where the likely targets had plenty of time to move their money stashed abroad, will influence Putin's behavior, and whether a threatened U.S. military attack on Assad will deter further provocations or trigger a wider war in Syria. Then we'll examine why the White House press corps tolerates the sneering contempt that the press secretary Sarah Sanders levels at them daily while flagrantly lying as she defends her boss, the liar-in-chief, often to the point of laughable absurdity. Eric Bollett, a senior writer for Share Blue Media and author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, joins us to analyze the extent to which the press enables Trump's reality TV presidency and government by stunt by following the bright, shiny light down the rabbit hole instead of shedding light by exposing the obvious lies and sleight of hand of a tawdry and transparent carnival huckster. Then finally, we'll get an update on the elections in Hungary that were marred by ugly Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, and speak with Charles Gatti, a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the author of Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt. He joins us to discuss whether today's strong turnout means a further drift to the right, empowering the government of the increasingly authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, or that the splintered opposition might win enough seats to constrain Orban in his fourth term in office. And joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and is the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, and her forthcoming book is In Putin's Footsteps. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And what do you make of Donald Trump's first public rebuke of Vladimir Putin?
Well, I find it very remarkable. In fact, actually, when I saw it this morning, I took a double take because it is, I think, the first time he ever mentioned Putin by name in negative terms, or sort of such explicit negative terms, and putting him next to Iran, which, as we know, is not Trump's favorite. So we'll see how the Moscow reacts. So far, they have not been a reaction. Maybe they will skip this one and see if further negative mentioning of Putin by Trump will proceed, whether it will be called off and whatnot. But I think with the Kremlin list that and the new sanctions, just over 20 people, the Putin associates have been put on and now sanctioned, and as well as businesses, it does seem that kind of the fight is on, the game is on, and either side is going to look for ways to save face, have some sort of maybe relationship, but if all fails, actually would be in full blown out war and insults, and in fact the relationships would go even further down than they already have been.
Well, if there is a response, and Donald Trump threatened it in his tweet that Russia, Iran, and Assad would pay a big price. When there was a prior use of chemical weapons, Trump fired, I think, 80-something cruise missiles at a Syrian air base. So would that change the calculus or, at that time?
Well, I think it can only escalate. I don't think that, I mean, Putin doesn't blink. We've seen it in 18 years he's been in power. So I wouldn't imagine that that in fact, that would probably prove once again to what the Kremlin, may not necessarily Putin himself, but the Kremlin or the Russian elites have been saying that you can, you know, even when the Americans want to fix the relationship, like Donald Trump saying he has been, you really cannot trust them. And in fact, the Ministry of Defense just came out with a new document, and the Ministry of Defense and the Foreign Ministry saying that the Americans are using any fake or false pretense to get involved in Syria further and undermine Russian influence there. So really, even if we haven't heard anything from the Kremlin, we already heard from two important ministries that say we are not blinking, we are not taking it, and we are going to respond in kind.
But they didn't say a word when the U.S. military wiped out at least 200 of the Wagners of a group of mercenaries.
They didn't. Well, I mean, but that, you know, that was a step. They didn't. The story came out. They came out with the story back saying that, you know, all these people can and have the right to be in Syria. But now the Ministry of Defense is saying, once again, I mean, I think the language is important, is saying that if the United States gets involved in military actions in Syria, where the Russian military men are. So it also depends of whether they're regular military forces or contractors who, for now, at least the Russians say they're not responsible for.
But the very spot where the Wagners attacked with the Syrian Fifth Corps, and there's some confusion over to whether the Russians knew about it or not. It's hard to believe they didn't. As we mentioned, they didn't say anything when they got wiped out by U.S. air power. But apparently the Russian military units, along with the Iranian military units, are within about 2 miles of the American positions, and that's making the Americans nervous. And they apparently regularly complain over their hotline to the Russian commanders saying, you know, back off, because we don't like having all that heavy armor pointed at us. So it is, I think, by all definitions, a pretty hair-trigger situation.
Well, it is. I mean, it has been, just between Trump and Putin generally, who are not shy both to exercise their, you know, mouth or their muscle. So it has been absolutely a trigger situation, and it's not getting better. So I'm glad that Trump finally called Putin out, but I don't know how far it's going to go and what the results of that calling out would be. Perhaps if there is a consistent policy towards Russia between the president and the rest of the White House or the rest of the American institutions and everybody would agree that they need to have a consistent policy with Putin. That may result in something, but so far the only thing we saw is just one tweet and one mentioning.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who is the professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And her forthcoming book is In Putin's Footsteps. Let's talk a little bit about you've spent a lot of time recently in Russia I want to get a sense of, you know, I rely often, I have Russian contacts, but I also rely a lot on American experts on Russia, and most of them, frankly, have been consistently wrong for decades. And by extension, maybe my analysis has been a little off. There is a documentary that's very interesting made by a Russian filmmaker called Our New President. That's a compilation of all of the Russian media coverage that they gave of the 2016 election, where they were really the cheer squad for Trump, and they featured an awful lot of Jill Stein. And of course, as you know, the Green Party candidate was convention was hosted by RT, and she was in that famous RT 10th anniversary, sitting at the table with General Flynn, Vladimir Putin, and Julian Assange's father. And she won enough votes in those three key swing states to have caused Hillary's loss, certainly more than the $77,000 votes that Hillary Clinton lost by. So if that was a Russian operation or a part of the active measures, that alone was pretty successful. But that was a really big feature. But the long and the short of it is that what I'm told is that the Russian people think that their leader is such a genius that he put Donald Trump in the White House, and therefore they don't have to worry about the Americans because they own the guy in the Oval Office. Is that a valid scenario or interpretation?
Well, I've never encountered that. In fact, what I've encountered is that your Trump is such an idiot. What are you bitching about us for? That we have Putin and we love Putin. So that's not what I've seen. They were very complimentary. I mean, not necessarily complimentary. Actually, they were not, but sort of very extensive reports on Trump and how much he wants to be friends with Russia and how wonderful it is, comparing to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So that certainly was pushed as a major story. As for the Russians thinking that they don't need to worry about America anymore, that's not what I heard at all, ever. More than anything, they were excited that Trump wants to fix relationship with Russia because, as you I'm sure know, Russia feels that it was the West has been incredibly unfair to it after the end of the Cold War, really humiliated Russia and just made it into a butt of every joke. And so when the guy comes in and says we're going to be different, then of course that was very welcomed. But also I think the great appeal of Trump in some way is that he's a reality TV character. I mean, I just heard your announcement about your second or I think third segment about media sort of essentially normalizing Trump, even when they're not normalizing Trump. And I think that is attractive in a universe of entertainment. That's attractive in every country. And so that is something that is an appeal. And it's certainly for Putin and for generally the Russians, the idea that somebody thinks that they may have elected the American president, it is sort of a complimentary idea. I mean, Putin was trained to fix political systems in some ways, in his tiny, small little way of a colonel in an insignificant town of eastern Germany. He certainly was trained to observe the mind of the nation or the mind of the city, the mind of the ideas that the country has. So for him, that is the being perceived, regardless of whether he did it or not, the being perceived is an incredible coup. And even those who don't like Trump still think, oh, my God, if, you know, even if he didn't do it, if the Americans think that we, such an insignificant country for the United States that really just swept us under the rug after the Cold War, now give us credit that we could elect their president, whether we like it or not, that's the coup. So we are not that insignificant. So in some little weird way, or strange way, in reverse logic, that also becomes a compliment to Putin. Even by those who dislike him, disagree with him, it still gives him a perception of strength.
So, well, Putin certainly got it right when he described Trump as a Yalki, which I understand means one who likes the limelight, likes to be the center of attention in the way that Trump certainly knows how to play as a reality TV star. He certainly knows how to play that.
Well, and absolutely, and you know, we know even from, you know, from history, from even before all investigations started, that when Trump brought his Miss Universe to Moscow, he was incredibly eager to meet with Putin. He was promised he would meet with Putin. Putin didn't show up for that possible event for that is was attached to Miss Universe. Miss Universe pageant. So we do know that he has this kind of admiration for the limelight, and also wanted at the time wanted to be next to this, as he perceived, very powerful man. So that is also kind of complimentary to Putin. So I'm not of the mind that Putin just thinks that Trump is the greatest thing that happened to humanity. If at best he's a useful fool, and that's how I think that the Kremlin is looking at him.
So you mean Poliznyi Durak? Would it go that far?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was probably exactly. Yeah. I mean, when we were talking about, you know, oh, and they were celebrating our president. They were. They were just. They were celebrating a guy that said that he wants better relationship with Russia, and more than anything, they were uncelebrating Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's what the major thing. That uncelebration of Hillary Clinton was the celebration for Donald Trump.
Right. Well, the other thing that I wanted to run by you just to make sure that I'm on the right track here, there's a symmetry between the Oval Office and the Kremlin, in the sense that those who would speak truth to power have been purged. Not that we had, you know, not that Tillerson was any great Secretary of State, but he's gone, McMaster's gone, a sycophant's come in, a Secretary of State, Pompeo, and a raging hawk has come in tomorrow as the National Security Advisor, John Bolton. And similarly, a while back, Putin got rid of Sergei Ivanov, and he seems to be surrounded by sycophants, hawks, and hardliners like Nikolai Patrushev. So do you see that symmetry?
Well, to some degree, but not really as a direct symmetry, because America was a democracy. So what's happening in America is almost inconceivable. But in Russia, it's not inconceivable. I mean, it has always been an autocracy, even if it's best democratic times, or so the West sees them during Boris Yeltsin. I mean, these were the times when also unuseful or troubling people would be gotten out of power, and those who would agree with a great leader would come in. I mean, Putin himself made it into the Yeltsin orbit because the former KGB colonel made it into the Yeltsin orbit, and he was at the time was the president of the Federal Security Bureau, which was a successor to KGB, precisely because Yeltsin wanted somebody who would protect his own chaotic money or his own chaotic legacy. So I wouldn't really make that comparison. I would just say how horrible it is that we now under Trump compare the events that are happening in the White House with the likes like Russia, with the likes like Turkey, with the likes like India and other countries that may look democratic and at times are better in democracy than at other times, but certainly more susceptible to the strong hand leadership. So I think that, for me, that is a better question, is that how do we get here with Trump? Not necessarily that Russia is like America. America is becoming more like those other autocratic countries.
Well, just in closing, I'd like to get your take on Nina Khrushcheva on the why it is apparent that Putin has pushed the envelope by apparently authorizing this chemical attack on the Russian exile, and also today's tweets by Trump, and this possibility that Trump, of course, he took the advantage of the situation to once again blame Obama for quoting Trump's tweet today. If President Obama had crossed his stated red line in the sand, the Syrian disaster would have ended long ago. Animal Assad would have been history. So there seems to be a link, at least in the terms of use of chemical weapons, both in the UK and in Syria.
Well, once again, you know, in Syria, there's in England, that the poisoning of the Skripals is something that I don't know if Putin gave an order. I mean, the way I imagine that may have happened is that in 2010, when Skripal was responsible for kicking out 10
exposed the network of sleepers. Among them was that chaplain. What was the name?
And one of them actually also was my student, Richard Murphy. So it was an interesting time. And so Skripal did this, and Putin, former KGB man, doesn't forgive. I mean, I'm just speculating, doesn't forgive things like that. And I think at the time, something may have been said to the point that, you know, we get rid of traitors. And it may have taken them 8 years to get to that traitor, as they see Sergei Skripal. But what I think, I mean, what I agree with you completely is that it seems to me that chemical weapons, despite the fact that Russia had all this checked and rechecked and apparently has no chemical weapons, it just doesn't seem to be the case, because even if it's not proven, I mean, there's still the breadcrumbs keep leading to Russia. And I think this is probably something that, you know, the world really needs to take a very serious look at and really address Russia in that regard, and really start conversing with Putin about that particular issue.
Well, just in closing, I saw the movie that's been banned in Russia, The Death of Stalin, and your grandfather, Nikita Khrushchev, the former Soviet leader, is played by Steve Buscemi. Not a flattering movie in any way, although, it was hardly worth banning. Have you seen it, or what did you hear about?
Well, as you said, not a flattering. They made Khrushchev the worst idiot of them all. They actually had the had the nerve to ask me if I want to have a private screening and maybe write about it. And I politely declined, because it's still my family. I mean, I'm critical politically, but and also, I mean, they had a really bad, what I've seen, I saw pieces of it, they had a really bad history advisor, because they made main character there is Malenkov, who was important by title, but was completely not important in terms of influence. And so this is something anybody who studies Russia should know, that whatever is written on paper doesn't mean that it's what it is in reality. After all, Putin was a colonel in the KGB, and look at him now. So no, I didn't see it. I think it was not worth banning. I think the Russians did the stupid thing. They should have actually showed it in every single movie theater across Russia and say, look, they're so afraid of us, of all the things that we can do, that our great leaders, they show as total morons. That's a sign of fear that the West has of Russia. And that would have been a great, brilliant political PR. But I'm not the Kremlin PR person.
Just as well. I thank you for joining us, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, and is the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, and her forthcoming book is In Putin's Footsteps. We're going to take a brief station break and back, examining why the White House press corps tolerates the sneering contempt that the press secretary, Sarah Sanders, levels at them daily while flagrantly lying as she defends the liar-in-chief. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Bollett, who is a senior writer for ShareBlue Media and the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He worked for 5 years as a senior writer for Salon.com, where he wrote extensively about media and politics. And prior to that, he worked as a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Bollett.
Thanks for having me.
And Eric, I was particularly astounded by Sarah Sanders' remark the other day when a reporter from the White House press corps mentioned what the outgoing fired National Security Council head, General McMaster, had said, basically criticizing Trump for being soft on the Russians and not in any way standing up to them so that they would continue to do meddle in our elections, et cetera, and push the envelope. And she, in this amazingly bald-faced lie, said, no, that's not what General McMaster said. He said that nobody's been tougher on Russia than Donald Trump, which is exactly what Trump had said. And the press corps just sat there like a bunch of, you know, dummies. I mean, just like, oh, okay, you know. Moving on, you know.
Yeah.
Why didn't they all get up, except for Fox and Sinclair and Breitbart, why didn't they all get up and walk out? I mean, why be lied to in such an insulting way?
Right. It's amazing to watch. And the example you give is a good one. 99 people out of 100 probably didn't even notice who watched it, and 8 out of 10 people in the room, it didn't even register. But you're right. It was just a bold-faced lie in real time in which she didn't deny it, she didn't obfuscate, she completely inverted it. McMaster, fired, embarrassed, kicked out of the administration, was incredibly clear in a major national security public forum, saying we haven't done enough against Russia. I mean, he used acceptable kind of D.C. rhetoric, but if you read between the lines, it was a blistering attack on his former boss. And Trump, and so Sarah Sanders just says, oh, that's not what he said. And you just had, you know, this expert on Russia and the Kremlin. And, you know, this is all kind of the fog of knowability that Putin thrives on. And we're to the point where not only aren't lies being called out, people have kind of even given up, and we're to the point where Sarah Sanders will, in this case, essentially say up is down and black is white and everyone nods. They have become so desensitized to being lied to on a daily, hourly, weekly basis. It's just amazing. And the question is why? If any other administration, and certainly any other Democratic administration, had a White House press secretary who lied for one day out of the year, the way Sarah Sanders does, it would be holy hell. I mean, there would be a revolt, literally pitchforks at the door. You can go back and read, look at the YouTube clips. Jake Tapper got one of his big breaks in D.C., early on in the Obama administrations, he basically picked fights with Obama's press secretary on a very regular basis. You know, those clips kind of went viral. The conservative media loved it. And that's kind of how he brandished his early reputation, which was he was going to pick fights with Obama's press secretary. It wasn't about lies. It was mostly on semantics. It was mostly on optics. It was kind of D.C. gotcha stuff. Fast forward to where we are now, and this is a press corps. This is specifically a White House press corps that so clearly values access over anything else. They become completely numb, and it's embarrassing to watch on a daily basis.
So is it naive to expect the press to act in solidarity? Because remember the first press conference that Trump held, he went after the CNN reporter, Jim Acosta,
right,
and called him a liar and said, fake news, fake news, shut him up, wouldn't talk to him. just basically bullied a reporter, or tried to bully him into silence. That was a moment where, again, I thought the press corps ought to just walk out. Like, okay, right. You know, if you don't, if this is how you disrespect us, then screw you. You know, but didn't they all act? I'm talking about the people, the media owners and editors who send these reporters in, and basically, you don't last in the White House press corps unless you get the scoop. So that's why they all sit there and take these daily insults. Because their bosses put them there, but their bosses have actually acted in concert, believe it or not, I recall, against Obama.
Yeah, sure. They could. There's an array of options that they could do. They could not, you know, they could boycott the White House press briefing for a day, for a week. If Trump goes on one of these hateful attacks against the media, there's no constitutional right that representatives from the White House have to be invited onto the Sunday morning shows. If Trump spends his week bashing the press, nobody from the White House is on the Sunday morning shows, and you can have a conversation without them. But yeah, so I have argued for we're on 3 years now. When the Trump campaign in late 2015 started herding reporters into metal pens at campaign rallies, which was a shocking, unprecedented move. It was a sign of contempt. It was a way to intimidate. By the summer of 2016, those reporters were in those herded pens while Trump would encourage people to scream insults at them and things like that. It became very dangerous. And I argued at the time, my God, you know, what are you people doing? You know, gather your forces, confront the Trump campaign, and say, we are not going to be herded into these metal pens. A, well, we just won't show up. If Trump campaigns weren't televised live, Trump obviously would have made a change. But they all refused to do it. And people argued, you know, particularly on Twitter, they'd say, well, you know, news organizations aren't supposed to band together. They're supposed to be independent. That would be beating up on Trump. No, that's not how it worked. And when I was at Media Matters, I wrote a column on, you know, well into the Obama's second administration, there was, in retrospect, a very minor policy change in terms of who could photograph Obama in the White House. The White House, like every other White House, wants to have more control. They gave their staff photographer, you know, slightly more control or access. There was a four-alarm fire within the Beltway media. There was an emergency meeting in D.C. Almost a dozen news organizations sent representatives. They decided what they were going to do to push back against the Obama White House. They sent this angry letter. There was an article in the Times where a journalist compared Obama White House to Russia's Pravda because they were trying to control and censor the press. And looking back, this was for a comically minute policy change on photography inside the White House. Obviously, what the Trump White House has done has been about 500 times worse and more destructive, and they clearly are trying to dismantle the free press. And these news organizations just twiddle their thumbs, and they send the reporters in to sit and be insulted by Sarah Sanders every day. It's an astonishing thing to watch. You know, we're coming up on the White House Correspondents Association dinner. They're all going to pat themselves on the back. They're doing this amazing job. They're doing such a great job covering Trump, and it's laughable. I mean, it's absolutely laughable. And they are getting pushed around, and Trump is winning this war on the media. It's a TKO at this point. It's not even a contest.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Bollett, who's a senior writer for ShareBlue Media and the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He worked for 5 years as a senior writer for Salon.com, where he wrote extensively about media and politics. And prior to that, he worked as a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. Well, Trump corralled the press in these metal cages,
yeah,
and then riled up his audiences by, sure, attacking the disgusting, he used that word, disgusting liars, lowlifes, horrible people, And he singled out, I recall at one point, to Katie Turr of NBC.
Sure. She needed proof.
She had to be escorted out by the Secret Service to protect her from the mob. I mean, so they didn't do anything at that point.
Nope.
But at the same time, the press gave Trump $5 billion worth of free advertising because they couldn't stop covering his antics. Right. And to the point where CBS's head, Les Moonves, said, well, Trump may not be good for America, but he's sure good for CBS. Does that say it all?
Yeah, and it's still the case. There was a piece, I saw the headline last week floating around, just talking about the extraordinary number of working journalists in D.C. right now. I mean, it is off the charts. It is the golden years, particularly if you're at a certain level, certain elite level in Washington, D.C. I mean, talk about full employment. Obviously, Trump has done amazing, produced amazing ratings for the cable news channels. The clicks are through the roof. So, yeah, that's the dirty little secret. And that's, again, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, they're all going to pat themselves on the back. And one of the ways they know they're doing a great job is their ratings and their readership and things like that. So, unfortunately, it just plays into where Trump wants them to be. He wants to turn this into a reality TV show, and they seem, most of them, you know, I'm obviously generalizing a lot. There is some very good journalism that's been done. But in general, it's not up to where it should be. And just a quick point. I mean, I have the news on all day, and you know, particularly CNN during the day, and they'll cut away to Trump, and he'll, you know, last week when he's talking about the border, he'll have these insane comments, completely detached from reality, and then they'll go back to CNN, and they're literally having the exact same conversation they had 15 months ago. The exact same tone. Oh, this is unusual. Presidents don't normally say this. Well, you know, I think Trump was actually wrong when he said, you know, illegal border crossings are at an all-time high. They're actually at an all-time. And, you know, they'll kind of quietly and slowly walk through readers through, your viewers through. Gee, this, you know, this might not all add up. I mean, my God, are we going to do this 3 or 4 years into his presidency? When are people just going to start finally, in a very blunt way, after Trump's has one of these events, go back to CNN and they talk about how he's a pathological liar, not in a hype, you know, in a loud partisan way, just in a very factual way, just constantly call him a liar, constantly suggest that he, you know, he might not be mentally stable, because that's what our country is dealing with. Why? You know, Trump has advertised that fact for 15 months. Why is it up for the press to kind of make it okay or take the edge off or kind of water it down so everyone won't get worried? Call it what it is. A journalist's job is to describe what is right in front of you. And Trump has made it perfectly plain who he is for 15 months. And a lot of people are still tiptoeing around it. They just don't want to deal with reality.
Well, in the opening, I said that you and I would be discussing how the press enables Trump's reality TV presidency and government by stunt, by following the bright, shiny light down the rabbit hole instead of shedding light by exposing the obvious lies and sleight of hand of a tawdry and transparent carnival huckster. So am I bleating into the wind here, do you think? I mean, my sense is that the real Achilles heel of Trump and the way he behaves, and frankly, it's exactly why he did this stunt on the border, was because he's worried that Ann Coulter was starting to criticizing him for not building his wall. Right. So he's afraid to lose his base, because the minute he loses his base, then the Republicans will stop supporting him because they'll be no longer afraid of his base, and then he'll be done. So that's my understanding of this. I think this guy's kind of a trapped animal, frankly, inside the White House, because he's totally incompetent. Obviously, he's clueless, and he's just throwing out these daily stunts. Do you think there'll be a point at which people will tire of this reality TV's star's performance?
I concerned that the answer is no. I mean, he claims to be worried about his base, and that's why he's doing this. There's absolutely no indication that his base will ever walk away from him. He could do whatever he wants. But he does throw up these distractions. You know, he watched Fox News last weekend. He was told there was this marauding caravan heading towards the border, when in fact it was a human rights march that's been held almost every year for a decade, and nobody really was too worried about it. So we're kind of into this weird hybrid of Wag the Dog and William Randolph Hearst. You provide the pictures, I'll provide the war. We're down the rabbit hole, except Donald Trump is not as nearly as smart and sophisticated and as a William Randolph Hearst. I mean, like you say, he's more mentally unstable than things like that. But again, back to the coverage, you know, he got a week out of coverage about the border, about the wall, about sending the troops, and you had to pay very close attention to get the fact that illegal border apprehensions are at a 47-year low. I mean, that should have been the headline in every story. That should have been the first sentence in every right. discussion.
Well, because they're basically letting Trump have it both ways. He claims credit for the drop in border crossings at the same time as trying to gin up this specter of an invasion from Mexico. By the way, our next guest, we were talking about the Hungarian elections, Orban, this sort of neo-fascist, he did the same thing. They had video, a faked video of holes in the border fence and Muslims pouring in to Hungary.
If you want to be frightened where America is heading, pay attention to what's happened in Hungary in the last few years. Absolutely, that's the model.
Right. So what's your sense then of whether MSNBC and CBS and CNN will stop sort of enabling him, in fact, feeding off the kind of opposition that they do on a daily basis, where they sort of deconstruct all of what Trump said, and they have these talking heads, many of them from the intelligence world and from the military. I understand probably why they're doing that. They're trying to reach out to Trump supporters who are, you know, thinking that these conservative authority figures might change their mind. I'm not sure that there's a valid strategy. But in general, the symbiosis continues as opposed to the resistance, the opposition. When are they going to start opposing this guy as opposed to having this symbiotic relationship with him?
Oh, never. I mean, that's the sad. I mean, there was some sort of forum last week where and it might have just been on Twitter, but again, it's something I saw floating around. One of the managing editors at the New York Times said, "We are not a resistance. We are not a resistance outlet. We don't want to be. We don't want to be seen as anti-Trump." Once you get to those kind of stratospheric levels of power in media and politics, I mean, the New York Times obviously has a century-old relationship with power that has gone up and down. But no, they don't see their job as being permanently opposed to this authoritarian madman, and they're just not going to. And if you read their coverage every day, they do their best, you know, in sometimes in huge, awful ways, other times in small but equally troubling ways, to normalize him. And they are just going to stick with this narrative that, oh, yes, he's eccentric. He's not like any other president, but they're going to treat his babble as some sort of policy thought. They're going to do background stories and pretend that Trump has any idea how immigration works, how taxation works, how tariffs work. You know, they just will not come out and say this guy is dumb as a brick and no one has any idea what they're doing. Because we haven't really talked about the larger issue is, of course, you know, the liberal media bias and how Republicans have just beat the Beltway press into submission for the last 4 or 5 decades. And everyone knows careers can be ended. If you become a target from a Breitbart campaign, if you become a target at Fox News, you absolutely run the risk of A, losing your access, of B, having your career dented. So you keep it down the middle, and yes, you can be tough on Trump some days, but then other days you have to pretend he's kind of like, not that different than Eisenhower. And you're just going to pretend, he's eccentric, and boy, he's unorthodox. So that's the path too many are taking. Again, I've generalized a lot.
Sure.
And there has been some good stuff in the last 15 or 16 months, but most of it has been, in my estimation, wildly feeble.
Well, Eric Bollett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Eric Bollett. He's a senior writer for ShareBlue Media and the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He worked for 5 years as a senior writer for Salon.com, where he wrote extensively about media and politics. And prior to that, he worked as a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an update on the elections in Hungary that were marred by ugly Islamophobia and anti-Semitism.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours. Making my entrance again with my youth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Charles Gatti, who's a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, a former senior advisor with the policy planning staff of the U.S. State Department, and a former professor at Union College and Columbia University. His books include Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt, and Zabig, the Strategy and Statecraft of Zabig New Brzezinski. He has an article at the Washington Post, Why Hungary's Prime Minister Blames George Soros for All of the Country's Woes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Gatti.
Thanks very much.
And Charles, do you have any sense of where the elections stand at this point? My understanding is, in broad strokes, what's at issue here is, first of all, there apparently is a strong turnout, and the question would be whether that means a further drift to the right, empowering the government of the increasingly authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, or whether the splintered opposition might win enough seats to constrain Orban in his fourth term. Is that what's at stake?
Well, what I can tell you are two things. One is that a far larger percentage of eligible voters showed up to vote because the Hungarian government puts out these lists very well. So I know that, for example, at 6:30 this evening, the local time, 68% of those voters voted, while 4 years ago it was 60%. So that's a fairly substantial difference. The polls should have closed now, but they're not closed in most places or many places, simply because there are long lines. They're still waiting to vote. Now, there's also some results. I have to put that in quotation marks because the results are not final by a long shot, but it is fairly clear. One result is fairly clear, and that is that the leading party, Mr. Orban's party called Fidesz, will get about 58% of the vote, as opposed to 66% and a two-thirds that was 4 years ago. Now, that's very significant, because with two-thirds you can change the constitution, and otherwise it's that particular method to turn the country further away from democracy is not available.
So in your article that I mentioned at the Washington Post about Orban blaming George Soros for all the country's woes, you mentioned a new verb that's entered the lexicon.
Yes. Well, it is to Soros or Soros, or in Hungarian it is Sorosozni, which means that you blame the Hungarian-American Jewish financier and philanthropist for the country's problems. This is an extraordinary campaign, the like of which I don't think any European country has ever seen, where you simply find a scapegoat for the unsolved problems of the country.
But there's been ugly Islamophobia, leaflets talking about holes in the fence and Muslims pouring into Hungary. But there's also been posters and George Soros with an exaggeratedly long Jewish-type nose. That's right. Pretty disgusting, isn't it?
That's correct. The primary issue is this. A couple of years ago, when so many migrants tried to approach Europe, and it was through, in large part, through Hungary, as well as through Italy and Croatia. But the Hungarian government found a way to keep them out and make the best of it, building on the prejudice of voters against foreigners. So, in effect, what Orban started was a campaign rooted on the slogan "Hungary for the Hungarians," and he played up Hungary's role in keeping foreigners, but particularly strangers from the east, out. And he pretended to be the defender of Christian Europe, I think that's why his reputation in the West, including in this country, has dropped so much in recent years.
But what explains this? I mean, it's a phenomenon that's happening around the world. Democracies are in retreat in Russia, China, Turkey, the Philippines, and certainly in Hungary and also in Poland. And the idea that Orban, I mean, he has Jobbik to the right of him, is right as he is, there's even more right-wing party, but he's resorting to the tactics of Joseph Goebbels. What happened to historical memory?
Well, that's a very broad question. I would say that Jobbik is no longer to the right of Fidesz. Fidesz is a far-right party today, and in the meantime has moved to the right, while Jobbik has moved towards the center. So it's a
wow.
Rather interesting opportunistic moves by both parties. In any case, what explains this is the repression of Hungarians under Soviet or Russian rule, and the feeling that Orban was able to generate that they ought to be patriots by keeping everybody out. And so his struggle is now primarily against Brussels and the European Union, from which Hungary benefits greatly, and about 3%, maybe 3.5% of its economy is financed essentially by the taxpayers of the rich EU countries.
But Orban studied at Oxford University on a scholarship paid for by George Soros. That's extraordinary.
The saying applies, good deeds don't go unpunished.
Uh-huh. Well, it's an extraordinary situation. And do you think there's anything that's going to stop this drift in Poland and Hungary towards authoritarian rule? I mean, I don't understand how the people feel. I mean, in this country, we have an authoritarian president, but we don't have an authoritarian country. And, you know, we have Fox News and Sinclair and a kind of right-wing cheer squad. But in Hungary and in Russia, of course, both Orban and Putin, the first thing they do is take over the media. And is that an explanation, that people are simply brainwashed into accepting authoritarianism?
Well, that's part of the explanation. Outside of the capital city of Budapest, you don't get too many different opinions at all. The primary television station or network is very strictly controlled by the government. Now, in Budapest, where it's unclear to me whether Fidesz even won the election, and, you know, 2 million people live there, they might have won, but if they did, it's around 51%. And it's very possible that even that's an inaccurate number. So the point is that if you don't have any alternative opinion available to the public, well, what can they do? That's all they hear. That's all they have always heard. Don't forget, this is now the 12th year of Orban's rule. He had 4 years at the turn of the century. Then he did lose an election in 2002, but now he's been back again. And
for a third consecutive term, right. Well, Charles Gaddy, I thank you for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
And again, I mean, speaking with Charles Gaddy, who's a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, a former senior advisor with the policy planning staff of the U.S. Department of State, and a former professor at Union College and Columbia University. His books include Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt, and Zbigniew, the Strategy and Statecraft of Zbigniew Brzezinski. And he has an article at the Washington Post, Why Hungary's Prime Minister Blames George Soros for All of the Country's Woes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.